Doctor Who, Short Trips. Damascus by Jonathan Barnes. Read by Tim Treloar.
I speak these necessary words not lightly, but rather with the heaviest of hearts. It began early on a crisp morning in July with the appearance in my chamber of he who was my personal secretary for the great majority of my time in Downing Street, the redoubtable Jason Sinclair. By this time in our professional relationship, Jason and I had become so simpatico that a simple clearing of the throat upon his part would, in me, elicit almost complete wakefulness. "Good morning, Prime Minister," he said, discreet yet insistent, his voice betraying an expensive education. "I'm sorry to wake you, sir, but it would seem that we have something of a crisis on our hands." I sat up in bed, rubbed my eyes and asked, "Whatever is it this time?" Nothing in his manner betrayed the least anxiety or surprise. Every syllable was smooth and precise. "It's a spacecraft, sir. It entered Earth's atmosphere 2 hours ago and is at present hovering somewhere in the vicinity of the Norfolk coast." "Oh, really?" I said, thinking of a pleasant walking holiday that I'd taken in that region shortly after graduating from Balliol. "Whereabouts?" "Close to a little town called Fakenham, I believe, sir, in a village called Cly." "Oh," I said, disappointed. "Never heard of it. So what's this spaceship, then? Anyone we know? And also, is there any chance of tea? And some toast? It's far too early to be thinking on an empty stomach." "I'll inform the kitchen, sir, but to answer your first question, the craft is not of any design with which we are familiar. It is alone and not, so far as we can tell, part of any fleet. You will be relieved to hear that it doesn't seem to represent any ambition on their part to invade. They have made no attempt so far to communicate." "Has it been seen," I asked, "by the public at large?" "I'm afraid so, sir. Seen and photographed. Here." He passed me a sheaf of black and white pictures, each depicting what looked like a large and gleaming hubcap hovering above a pleasant market town. "It's even been reported on a local radio station or two." "Good God!" I felt the stirrings of displeasure. "Aren't there supposed to be mechanisms in place to stop this kind of thing?" "A cover story's been released, but I fear that at least a little damage has already been done." "Where are UNIT in all of this? Surely this is their responsibility." If I hadn't known Sinclair better, I'd have sworn that, at this, a flicker of something very like irritation crossed his face. "The cover-up is of their doing, sir. They're blaming the delay on recent cuts in their budget."
"Humph! I can ask the Europeans about that. But what are they doing with this ship?"
"Well, that's just it, sir."
"What do you mean?"
"They seem altogether most reluctant to act. They insist that it's posed no threat so far. The headman's wary, I think, of seeming trigger-happy after what happened at Wenley Moor.
And this doctor of theirs, eh? The one we hear so much about. He who complained so bitterly last year about the project. What of him?"
"Ah, now, Prime Minister, he's rather the main sticking point."
"Explain."
"It would seem that the doctor is refusing to do anything whatever. According to my chief point of contact at UNIT, his precise words were, 'Tell them to look after themselves from now on.'"
"He refuses to help? Even to advise us?"
"That's correct, Prime Minister."
"Has he ever displayed such behaviour in the past?"
"He has been known to be somewhat erratic on occasion."
"I thought he was on our payroll."
Technically, sir, he's employed by UNIT, and it's my understanding, although this is only really barrack-room gossip, that he has yet to accept his fee."
Nonetheless, all the same, damn it, he has to help. He's the world expert. I took a long, deep, meditative breath before I declared, Right, very well, I've made my decision. Sir, we're going to see him, the doctor.
Prime Minister?
Fetch me my toast, I said. Pour me my tea and get the limousine ready. You and me, Mr. Sinclair, we're going on a journey to Unit HQ. Jason's face at this was something of a picture. This did not necessarily displease me, for I have long made it a rule in my political career always to do the unexpected. To succumb to predictability is, after all, to risk forfeiting the crown. I am sure that it is not necessary for me to delineate the reasons why I cannot even now reveal the precise location. It will be enough to state, and even this may be more than that organization might ideally prefer, that they were situated some 1.5 hours' drive from Westminster, nestled in the bosom of our home counties. The journey itself was not unpleasant. Speeding out of the city and into the countryside, with young Jason at my side and with summer sunshine on our faces. I had, as was always the case, a great deal of paperwork through which to sort, and for the first portion of the trip, I busied myself with the contents of my red box. As time wore on, however, and as the cares of London seemed to diminish, the expedition seemed to take on a subtly different air. Sinclair must have sensed my mood as he caught my eye when I was distracted momentarily from my papers and said, Prime Minister, if you cannot persuade the doctor, I don't believe there is a man in England who can. I admit that, at this, I felt a surge of gratitude for his faith. Thank you, I said. I appreciate your trust. The vehicle must have travelled at that moment over a pothole at speed, as Jason and I were flung briefly together, and brushed rather awkwardly, one against the other. The effect was rather curious, and was to inspire in me some subsequent consideration. I think often that such a thing would not now be possible, given the relentless nannying of the public by governments other than mine as to the supposed necessity of seatbelts. Unit base, when we reached it, turned out, rather disappointingly, to be a somewhat undistinguished country house of mid-Victorian vintage, surrounded by a scattering of ramshackle outbuildings which, taken in toto, seemed to have the air of a place which had, for obvious reasons, long been passed over by the National Trust. There was also, perhaps a little curiously, given the need for secrecy in such a place, the word unit quite clearly stated on a wooden sign outside, and beneath it, in oddly half-hearted type, Private Property, Stay Away. There were two guards at the gate, at the head of a gravel drive which led to the main building. Both were armed, but they wore looks of faint perplexity, as if expecting, at any moment, to be confronted by something lurid or outré. We were expected. Several phone calls between subordinates having made my position plain, and after the gate was drawn back, we were waved through. As we approached the house, I noticed that a large crane had been erected outside, there, one presumed, to effect some manner of repair or even extension. It was ugly in the modern manner, and it seemed to require 3 separate men to operate. It struck me as rather unwieldy, and I was pleased to note that we parked a sensible distance from it. Jason and I disembarked. We strolled towards the open door, and through the wood-panelled corridors until we reached a space that looked as if it had once been used as an agreeable billiard room, but which now had been pressed into service as a laboratory. The original door had been removed and replaced futuristically by one made of sheer glass. Beyond it was a profusion of metal wire and electronic equipment, in the midst of which, seeming almost regal,
was a man of about my own age, dressed with needless flamboyance in a velvet jacket and sporting a shock of white hair, which put me in mind of a late great aunt upon my mother's side. He was working on some small piece of machinery. Beside him was a blonde girl whom I imagine that many might have found attractive. She wore an expression best described as being one of quietly intense adoration. At the sight of our approach, she exchanged a word or two with the man and walked to the door to greet us. She stepped outside and closed the door behind her. She seemed apologetic in her manner. "Hello, I'm Joe." I nodded, never at my best when out amongst constituents. "A pleasure," I said, "but I would now like to have a word with the doctor." "He's not in a very good mood," she said. "You'll find him rather grumpy." Jason reached round and passed me a slim manila folder. "The dossier on today's incursion, Prime Minister. You may find it useful to bolster your argument." "Thank you," I said. "Wish me luck." And without waiting for any further discussion, I walked into the laboratory, the door swinging shut behind me. Sinclair and the woman called Miss Grant watched carefully through the glass, and I was put in mind of some foolhardy zookeeper, venturing unwisely into the pen of the most dangerous exhibit. The man in the velvet jacket did not look up as I entered, nor did he in any fashion acknowledge my arrival. I noticed, half hidden, obscured against one wall, a battered blue police box of a type which even then was on its way to obsolescence. I paused before the scientist and cleared my throat. Once, twice, three times. Only when I had begun to sound as though I was in need of medical attention did the doctor finally look up. We had never met before that moment, but he addressed me as though we had known one another for years. "Jeremy, my dear fellow, please don't stand there coughing like that. You're blocking my light." I glanced behind me. I saw Jason and Miss Grant watching events with rueful anxiety. "Doctor," I said, "evidently you know who I am." "Oh, I've a vague notion," he said, looking down again at whatever it was he was working on, that gleaming metallic piece of equipment. "After all, I come from a place that's full of men like you, bureaucrats and politicians." He shook his head with evident distaste. "Doctor," I said, "are you aware that there is, at present, a potentially hostile alien incursion taking place in this country?" The doctor did not answer my question. Instead, he peered close at the device before him. "See this, Jeremy?" he asked. "Do you know, I'm not entirely certain what it is, or even where it came from. It appeared this morning in my TARDIS. I wonder what they're up to this time. Rather pleasant, don't you think? Not to always know the answers." Again, I glanced at my observers, who seemed rather disheartened by the turn of events. "Look here, Doctor," I said, opening the dossier that Sinclair had given me and placing on the desk before him the same black-and-white photograph that I'd been shown that morning. "There's a spacecraft hovering somewhere off the Norfolk coast, and you don't seem the slightest bit interested." The doctor remained fascinated by the little machine in front of him. "It seems," he said, "it seems to be some sort of booster." "Doctor," I said, "please." "Ah," he looked up now, smiling condescendingly. "At last, manners maketh man." He looked very briefly at the photograph in front of him. "That's a Milia ship," he said.
"And what are they?"
"Oh, intergalactic traders. Specialists in military technology. Nothing for you to worry about. They'll be looking for merchandise of one kind or another. I shouldn't let it trouble you. Ignore them and they'll soon go away."
"Ignore them? Is that really your advice?"
"I do believe it is. They're only interested in what can make them money, you see. And there's little enough of that on this backwater planet to trouble them for long."
"Doctor, I can't say I'm altogether comfortable in simply doing nothing."
"Your comfort or otherwise, Jeremy, is a matter to me of sublime indifference. Now, if that's all, I really do need to concentrate on this. Do you know, I actually think it's
possible I might have crossed my own timeline in some fashion. I was about to formulate a response to these remarks when I heard from behind me a loud thump, as of a man of considerable height and weight slumping against glass. Miss Grant was sitting upon the floor, gazing with disquieting incuriosity at the ceiling, and Jason had actually gone to sleep. In the minute or so since last I'd looked around, he'd taken to his back and drifted off. The doctor, still absorbed by the strange technology before him, seemed not to have noticed. I cleared my throat again.
Good Lord, man, find yourself a lozenge.
His eyes flicked upwards.
Good grief!
He sprang to his feet, pocketed the device and strode towards the door. Within seconds he was outside and on his knees and examining the watches. By the time I reached his side he was up again, eyes blazing, all energy.
These people are the victim of a listlessness field. They've been rendered in a state of extreme passivity.
What's caused it? I asked.
At present I've only theories. Stay here, Jeremy, while I investigate. Don't wander off.
And he ran away from me, down the corridor.
I had the distinct impression that he was accustomed to such commands as this being summarily disobeyed. I, however, did not follow him, but dropped to my knees to make Jason comfortable. He was indeed fast asleep. There was nothing at all that I could do to waken him. I wished him well, left him with the others, and went back into the laboratory. There was a phone on the desk, of which I availed myself in order to make a series of necessary calls, to Downing Street, to Scotland Yard, and to the Palace. Uniquely in my premiership, and I should wager in any other, not a single one of these was answered. Afterwards, feeling by now, as you might imagine, a certain quality of extreme concern which, in many a lesser man, might have toppled over into panic, I made one final call. That, it turned out, was answered, but not by anyone I had expected. Not even, I was to discover much later, by anyone who was actually human. The precise details of that conversation I shall keep to myself, those subtle insults and put-downs. All the same, a sliver of it lingers still in my imagination. This is what was said to me. I can recall it word for word.
Lilla, Prime Minister, my name's Lilla, and I just hope this teaches you something important about taking what doesn't belong to you.
Once it was all over, the doctor stormed back into the room. He had from somewhere acquired a long and dashing cape which fluttered about him like a set of wings made in Savile Row.
Now, Jeremy, he said, you had better come with me. The milieu must be at the heart of it. Where did you say the ship was sighted?
East Anglia, a place called Clye.
So, are you game for a drive? Shall we beard them in their lair?
What's happening? I asked. I can't get any reply from anywhere.
Oh, no. Well, you wouldn't. Half the country's asleep, you see, and the other half might as well be. Didn't I tell you? It's a listlessness field.
I don't understand.
Then come with me, Jeremy, and you'll understand soon enough.
He strode away again, and this time I followed. As we walked through the headquarters, I saw that what had happened to Jason and Miss Grant had happened to everyone. Everyone but us. Soldiers and security men sprawled, dozing and glazed-eyed. The doctor strode ahead.
Keep up, Jeremy! And this has happened everywhere, I asked.
It must have done, the doctor said. All over this island of yours. When we left the building, I saw that the crane was now angled rather oddly, resembling some modernist sculpture.
What's happened here? I asked.
The crane? The doctor rubbed the back of his neck with an odd ferocity. The operator had fallen into a light doze at the controls. I had to take some necessary action. Rest assured, all's now quite well. No damage was done and nobody was harmed. Now, we must make haste to Clye. Clamber aboard, Prime Minister. The milieu awaits. And he gestured to a vehicle that I had not seen when we arrived at the unit base, to this day, the most ridiculous car that I have ever beheld.
I learned later, during that long day of listlessness, that cities had first slowed and then reached a standstill, that entire communities were reduced to somnambulism, that the nation, as a whole, set itself to drowsing. Although I was not entirely immune to its effect, my partial exemption from the influence of the field was subsequently ascribed to my being in such very close proximity to that mysterious metallic object which the doctor claimed to have found that very morning. Nonetheless, this must partially have been diminished, as, in spite of the sound and fury of that madcap journey, I somehow contrived to fall asleep. When I woke, it was to find the vehicle now stationary beside a stony beach in a dark, grey, uninviting sea. The doctor was shaking me back to consciousness.
Come on, Jeremy. This is no time for napping. We're at Clyde, and it is imperative we get on board that ship.
I saw at once what it was to which he referred. For that beach, desolate and unappealing though it was that afternoon, was by no means unoccupied. A vast, organic, tentacular object about the size of a small island could be sighted out to sea. The effect was nightmarish. The size of the thing cyclopean, its lines and angles of the sort that drives men irreparably insane. It twitched and flailed with evil intent, and the longest of his tentacles stretched almost to the shore. At the heart of it could be seen the outline of that hubcap-shaped object which I had seen that morning in the grainy photograph.
So that's the Milieu ship? I asked.
Yes, yes,
snapped the doctor, maddeningly blasé.
And they'll have seen our approach. Look lively, man.
He jumped from the car and strode towards the water's edge, crunching over the shingled ground to reach it. I stumbled out of the car and followed. The sound of our footsteps seemed to me profoundly ominous. The doctor paused a foot away, no more, from the churning sea. That weird, half-metal, half-fleshy monstrosity did not change or shift in any way, whilst also, somehow, contriving to suggest a deeply baleful reaction to our approach. The doctor called out, his imperious voice cutting through the shrieks of seabirds and the hiss of the ocean.
Gentlemen of the Milieu, I am the doctor, and under the terms of the Shadow Proclamation, I should very much like a word.
How can you be sure that they'll hear you? I asked. The doctor grinned.
Have faith, Jeremy.
No sooner had he finished his sentence before, accompanied by a strange electronic glissando, the sensation in my stomach akin to mild food poisoning, I felt myself be somehow disassembled, only to be put back together again a microsecond later in some quite different place. The effect was the cause of some understandable discombobulation on my part. I squeezed shut my eyes and found that I was shouting. When I opened them once more and forced myself into silence, I saw that I was standing for the first and to date final time in my life aboard the deck of an unequivocally alien spaceship. Facing us were almost 24 obvious extraterrestrials, furry, vole-like creatures dressed in silvery armor, much like a child's approximation of some ancient samurai, had they access only to tinfoil and sticky-backed plastic. Around us was an array of pulsing organic technology, centuries ahead of anything from Earth. Nothing about this thoroughly bizarre scenario seemed to strike the doctor as anything other than drearily quotidian. He addressed all of those strange, strange creatures as one, in the manner of a movie star speechifying to extras.
Now then, what the deuce do you think you're doing? What business have you here?
What do you mean by placing a listlessness field over this island? And more importantly of all, what do you mean by interrupting my day?
One of the vole creatures, whose silvery armour seemed rather more ornate than the rest, scuttled out to confront us. The doctor had to stoop and peer in order to look in his glittering eyes.
"What concern is it of yours?"
asked the little beast in a high, fluting, quavering voice.
"My concern," the doctor retorted, "is derived chiefly from a deep disdain for criminals and a certain fondness for seeing justice done. Now, I shall ask you again. Why have you placed this field over England?"
"Actually, Doctor,"
it said pedantically,
"the milieu have not created this effect."
"Is that so?" asked the doctor. "I had assumed it must be you. In which case, my apologies."
He flashed a sudden, charming smile.
"Nonetheless, I should appreciate a thorough explanation for your presence here."
"We are engaged upon legitimate business upon this sphere."
"Please elucidate," the doctor snapped.
"We have nothing to hide,"
said the alien, rather prettily.
"On the contrary, we are legitimate business beings. We are present on this planet, looking for a young female emigre from the planet Augustine's Mercy. She owns the listlessness device which was invented by her late father. We wish simply to speak to her, and to offer her a fair price for the galactic patent."
At this, the doctor's manner seemed to darken. "I've heard stories," he said, "about the way in which the milieu do business, and I have to say I never cared for it. Whoever this young woman is, let her go in peace."
"But don't you see, Doctor? It must have been she who activated the device today."
"Yes, no doubt upon learning of your unlicensed presence here. Jeremy?"
"Yes, Doctor?"
"This distinctly ugly spacecraft of theirs, was its arrival in the east of England reported by your primitive media?"
"Yes. I believe it made a local radio station or two."
The doctor turned back to the extraterrestrials.
"You see, gentlemen, your quarry must have heard of your arrival and fled. All this has been a consequence of your actions. You have no legitimate business here, and I would ask you to leave forthwith."
The alien shook its furred head.
"You have no authority to make such a demand."
"On the contrary," said the doctor, "I have all the authority I need, right here."
And he pulled from the pocket of his velvet jacket the gadget with which he had been tinkering in the laboratory at UNIT.
"What is that?"
the creature sneered. "Do you know, I'm not entirely certain. I'm not even quite clear how it came to be in my TARDIS, although I do have a range of theories connected with temporal geometry. All you need to know, however, is that this device operates, in essence, as a means to boost the listlessness field. If I press this button, the field will grow so powerful it will begin to affect all life, not just humanity. Only those within a tiny radius, namely the good Jeremy and myself, will remain immune."
The doctor's manner darkened now still further. I watched as his eyes filled with menace. It was as if the outward image, that of a patrician gentleman, was pulled aside to reveal what lay beneath. Something incalculably ancient, terrifyingly alien. "Leave this planet now. Recall any agents you have at large and go. If you do not do so, then I will press this button. I will take your ship, and I will see you all incarcerated according to the laws and customs of these people. And you may take it on good authority that a British prison cell in the 1970s, when you look as you look, will be no very pleasant place to stay."
At this, several of the creatures stepped involuntarily back. Their leader, to his credit, stood firm.
"You're bluffing!"
The man in the cape glowered down at them. "I invite you, sir, to test the truth of that assertion." There followed after that a very long pause, as in a crucial juncture in some game of cards. And then, all of a sudden, it was over. Without any warning, I felt again that strange sense of disassembly, and within seconds, the doctor and I found ourselves standing once more on the beach. Before us, The ship's strange tentacles were retracting at speed, curling back inside that hubcap exterior. The doctor seemed grimly satisfied. In the distance, we heard a sound like thunder. Lights dappled the spaceship's exterior. They're recalling their agents, the doctor said, just as I asked them to. All the tentacles were now back inside the ship. We watched as the shining disc first rose, rather uncertainly, into the air. Then, as if it were gaining confidence, speeding into the horizon before, at last, it disappeared. The doctor gestured towards his car. Prime Minister? He asked. Shall we? As we crunched together over the shingle towards the waiting vehicle, I drew a deep breath and said, Doctor.
Yes?
I ought to be honest. Honest about what?
It is my belief that I spoke earlier today to the young lady from Augustine's Mercy for whom the milieu was searching. We had reached the car. The doctor stopped and turned to face me.
I should like you to explain, he said very quietly.
When the field first hit, I said, I made, as you know, a number of telephone calls to Downing Street, to the palace, to the yard, and also to one other. But only that last call was answered.
Jeremy, who did you call last?
I swallowed hard. I called the Damascus Project. A young lady was there. I imagine that she was endeavouring to use that technology to escape the milieu. She told me all this would teach me about taking what doesn't belong to me. For a moment, there was only the sound of the sea. The doctor said, So, the Damascus Project remains active?
It does, I said.
Against my express instructions last year that it was to be closed down immediately?
That is so, I said. But that decision was mine. You have no jurisdiction, after all, over any policies of this government.
The doctor looked at me with contempt. You think that you can overrule me, Jeremy?
Doctor, I said, I am grateful for everything you've done today, but I know full well, as Prime Minister of this country, that I can always overrule you.
He looked at me, his expression composed in equal parts of fury, disappointment, and sorrow.
Oh, Jeremy, he said, shaking his head.
Well, you can walk back to London, I think.
And this said, he leapt into the roadster, started the engine, and drove away at speed, pebbles flying upwards as he went. I was too startled to protest, and by the time I called out, it was too late. To my baffled disbelief, the car disappeared into the distance and did not return. And so I stood alone, upon the beach of Cly, stranded beside the sea. And as I listened to the roar of the ocean, I came in a flash to realize what should long ago have been quite plain, that the doctor is a dangerous alien in our midst, that his morality is not at all as ours, that he is unlicensed and unaccountable, and that he represents, in my view, for all the incidental good he may have wrought down the years, the single most significant threat to the ongoing security of this great nation. So this, then, is why I have made this recording. To let those who come after me understand these three crucial truths.
That the doctor is not at all as he seems. That he is, in fact, a source of the gravest peril to this sceptred isle, and that he must, at all costs, be stopped.